Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Imperfect Leaders. In today's competitive world, everyone is looking for an advantage, especially when it comes to finding world-class talent. This is true in business, politics, and especially sports. The NBA, for example, has become a huge, global, high-profile business. There are scouts all over the world analyzing players, video, data, and statistics. Everyone has a point of view, and everyone is looking for some kind of an edge. I wanted to talk to one of the best leaders in the entire NBA, a guy named Tim Connelly, today's guest. And he was the chief architect and helped the Denver Nuggets win its very first world championship last year. He was then recruited by the Minnesota Timberwolves, a team that is now, unsurprisingly, number one in their brutally competitive division. So what makes Tim such a great leader? Is it that superior data and analytics? Nope. Actually, it's the exact opposite. Tim's an emotionally intelligent leader. He knows how to build authentic relationships. He's highly empathic and comfortable in his own skin. He's powerful, but he doesn't take himself too seriously. He wants to win right now, but he knows patience is a competitive advantage in a world that's awestruck with immediate gratification. Tim knows how to bounce back from failure, and yes, he's never afraid to make a tough decision, even if he knows or at least thinks he might be wrong. This is something all great leaders and all disciplines somehow master. So I hope you'll enjoy today's conversation with my new friend, Tim Connelly, GM of the Minnesota Timberwolves. So Tim, just a few months after signing a blockbuster deal with the Minnesota Timberwolves to be their general manager, you orchestrated a huge deal to secure the talents of all-star center Rudy Gobert. And it was a very competitive process, a bidding process. And we already get the sense that it's worth it because you're number one in the West, a brutally competitive division. So let's just dive right in. How the hell did you get him? What's the negotiation process like to get a superstar like Rudy Gobert?
He's a pretty coveted guy. And we thought the opportunity to add a guy with that much winning behind him was rare. We also, you do as much background as possible with a market like ours. You want to ensure that the guy's going to be happy here. You know, we're not a Miami or one of the coastal cities. And we thought it was really important to, for an organization that hasn't had as much success as others, was to get as many guys here that work ethic, used to winning, and surround guys like Anthony and Carl with those type of players. So, we were pretty aggressive, the debatable level of aggression. Obviously, we gave up quite a bit, but we thought when you're able to add an elite defensive player and an elite professional, as importantly, as his production on the court, just who he is as a guy and the kind of the tone he can set in terms of work ethic and approach, we thought it was worth the very heavy offer that we made, and we got something done.
When you say heavy offer, am I right? Was it five players and five picks?
No, it wasn't five picks, but it was a lot of players. We had several first-round picks. We have a swap. We traded a first-round guy we took. I guess technically Walker Kessler was a guy we took in the draft we really liked, and he's a great guy. He's a heck of a player. So it's never fun to trade people, period. It's kind of a gross concept. So we traded guys that have really been impactful here for the turnaround the year prior to my arrival, and Walker was a new face. So it's probably the least enjoyable part of the job. The idea that you're trading human beings, it's not just, it's easy to do it from a computer screen, but to talk to a guy and tell his family they're going elsewhere. So we trade a lot of really good players, guys that have, you can see what Walker's doing. Jared Vanderbilt just signed a well-deserved contract extension in LA. Pat Beverly's the definition of a winner. Malik's doing great in Milwaukee. A lot of really good players and a lot of draft capital to get Rudy.
You say it's kind of a gross concept to trade human beings, and I agree. And it must be one of the toughest parts of your job. I mean, I just started fantasy basketball for the very first time this year, and it's tough to trade somebody just on a computer screen. But you do it you're trading human beings. So how do you get comfortable? What is the process like to get comfortable trading human beings for another human being? I mean, take us behind the scenes there.
I don't think I've ever gotten comfortable with it. And quite frankly, there's probably been some potentially beneficial team deals that I haven't done because it didn't feel right. If a guy just moved his family, or a guy done right by the organization and the team you're trading to might not be a place real conducive to his growth or continued success. So I think as long as you're honest with guys, you know, you can never tell a guy that he's untradeable. I think everyone, you know, you have to be very leery of being consistent with your words. That's all you can hope for, but it's not a comfortable position to be in. It's not enjoyable, and it's something, you know, when we can avoid it, we avoid it.
And so when someone leaves or they're part of a package like Pat Beverly, do you still maintain a relationship with him after he leaves?
Yeah, I didn't know Pat well, so we didn't really have a relationship, but most of the guys that I've, traded or elsewhere, I still talk to quite often. More than the same market, we try to connect. The relationships is the part that I think is most enjoyable. And again, it's the one that's most controllable. So I think, you know, and I've told guys, we have traded guys before, like, what a dumb move by me. Should never trade you. Stupid.
After the fact, you go back and say that was a dumb move on my part.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Or gosh, should have re-signed you. That was dumb. That was stupid. So, you know, the guys that you've known for a while, the relationship shouldn't end because you're wearing a different jersey. Or I'll hit guys that they're on different teams. Like, you look like garbage last night. You know, you weren't playing hard enough, or you got to get back to doing this or that. So again, that's by far my favorite part of the job, that you're meeting these really cool, interesting people from all walks of life that otherwise you wouldn't really get to know. And I want to keep those relationships going forever.
And what's the dynamic like when you're trying to figure out exactly what you need to trade to secure the talents of somebody like a Rudy Gobert? I mean, it's so ambiguous, and all we see as fans is the final output, but how do you decide, and what's the give and take?
Like any other business, we all have reputations. Some guys are more risk averse. Some guys are more willing to, you know, push more chips on the table. The timing of the deal is very impactful. Obviously, if you look at our league over the last year, you've seen a shifting landscape with a new CBA. So that changes dramatically what you would do and how you might do it. And then it's just a guess. And I think the final thing is, do you want to get a deal done, or do you want to, I think at times there's some paralysis by the fear of instant analysis. You know, it's such a now. It's like, I get a kick out of when teams get draft grades the day of the draft, you know, before guys played a game. Yeah. So I do think there's increasing scrutiny and fear of scrutiny as our game's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, as the news cycles are 24/7. You know, social media has become kind of the dominant news breaker. You know, hopefully, you know, we use this term all the time. It's corny, but just be informed with your mistake, do your homework, make a decision, and then, you know, move on.
And how do you get comfortable with risk in making a decision? Because like you say, you've had deals before in the past where you've said to the person that was stupid. And, you know, so how do you get comfortable knowing that you made stupid mistakes in the past when you have to make a really big decision? Because it's not only something that affects a general manager, it affects everybody, especially in business.
Yeah, I think it's a bit liberating when, you know, realize how much serendipity plays a role in all our success. You know, I don't care what you do. There's a tremendous amount of luck that's going to play into your success or lack thereof. Our league in particular, you think of some of the dynamics. I mean, we have a draft lottery, right? So a lottery ball can determine if you get a foundational piece, or it can determine if you get a guy that's going to be out of the league pretty quickly. So I think I try not to take it too seriously. You know, we're not, you know, there's a lot of more important industries than ours. I purposely don't really read much about our industry. I don't have any social media. I don't even have any, you know, sleeper accounts, anything. I trust that the guys and women I work with are really, really smart. They're going to ensure I don't do too many dumb things. And then you just make a decision. You know, you can't look back. You can't be crippled by the fear of potentially being wrong. Because if you have that concept, you're probably in the wrong industry, mm-hmm. and you're going to be stuck in neutral.
I love that. So no fear of potentially being wrong, because that would just be so crippling that would almost render you ineffective to make a big decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're going to be wrong. I've been, you know, I've gotten lucky a couple of times, but I've been wrong a million times. And you know, look back and look at those times when you're wrong, try to figure out if there was some glaring reason why you were wrong, or was it just, again, an informed mistake? You did all the background, you worked hard, you checked every information box you could probably make a decision, just didn't work out. And in our league, there's also a huge environmental aspect of success. You know, there's players on every team right now that aren't having big roles that will have a big role elsewhere. They just haven't found it with that team. So again, I think it is liberating to know how many things can impact success. And I think the less restricted you are by risk, I think the better.
And how much do you go back and forth when you're thinking of a big trade, for example? Like, do you go back and forth with the owners or with the coach?
Yeah, it's constant dialogue. I've been super fortunate. I worked for one of my best friends in Denver, so we had constant dialogue.
Who was that?
Josh Kroenke. Mm-hmm. Josh Kroenke, Michael Malone. I've known him forever, so you're just constantly talking. Calvin Booth, you know, Arturis Karnišovas. We've worked with all these really, really smart guys. Mm-hmm. Denver was fantastic because there was a degree of patience that was not always common in professional sports. And the Josh's vision and patience really paid off, obviously, with the championship. And Michael and Cal and those guys just killed it. But the dialogue when we were there was constant. Now I'm here, another great ownership group. You have Glenn and Becky. You have Alex Rodriguez. You have Mark Lori from very, very different walks of life relative to their professional background. So that's been really neat to get to know some really bright minds. And again, another group that's has the ability to be patient. I think I have an unfounded theory that patience is one of the best indicators of success right now in professional sports, because there is no patience. You know, and it's not just players. It's coaches. It's guys like myself. It's the ability for people to be in environments that can make mistakes and learn from those mistakes. So I've been super, super lucky from the Kroenkes to now Glenn and Becky and Mark and Alex and the people I've worked with in Denver and the people I've worked with here. It allows you to have constant open dialogue and be, you know, really toss ideas back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then, you know, do you reach a consensus? Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't, sometimes you got to be on your own. But again, as long as we beat it up enough to a point where we feel like we know what we're doing, I think then you can make a decision with, you know, feeling pretty good about it.
Is patience a real competitive advantage in professional sports? It's such a simple concept, but so few organizations embrace it. Is it because we're now just in a culture and a society of immediate gratification?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, I look at this slow build in Denver, and that's a direct result of Josh and Stan saying, we're getting there. You know, we're getting better. We see it. And again, I don't think patience should be unique to the young players. I look at Michael Malone, who's an elite coach. He got better and better and better. And that patience and that environment of patience allowed him to do so. Again, here we're lucky. We have ownership group that really wants to commit to people and wants them to learn and get better and better. We have Chris Finch, our coach here, is a brilliant coach. He's coached all over the world. He's coached in Europe. He's coached national team. He's coached in the G League. So his variety of experiences has allowed him to have this really cool basketball view. But even with coaches, he's getting better and better and better each game. Still only coached a couple of years in the NBA. So I'm a huge believer in it. I think if you're constantly looking for immediate gratification, it's, you know, you're kind of chasing your tail. Mm-hmm. You see in our league, how many first round guys are thrown back or available within the first 2, 3, 4 years because they didn't hit right away. I think it is. I think it's if you have patient ownership and you have a really good relationship between ownership, the coach, and I think the business side is important too. I think we have a great business leader here in Ethan. I think it's really important to, again, not always reach consensus. I think consensus is impossible to have that expectation before every decision, but to be communicative and really beat things up prior.
And what happens when you don't have consensus? Like, how are you empowered? Yeah. I mean, are you empowered to make a decision without consensus? And don't you, you know, risk pissing off Alex or, you know, one of your owners if you're making a decision without their buy-in?
Yeah. I mean, it's you try to avoid it. For example, for the coaches, I always give the guys I work, I give them the salary sheet and say, cross out the guys you hate, start the guys you love, and in between we'll talk about it. Hey, I've worked with for some really, really bright people. So when really bright people don't want to do something, it should give you pause. You know, I don't want to be a bully with deals. And then on the occasional situation, you kind of feel in your gut of guts that this is the right deal to do.
Give me an example of that. where you felt something in your gut but didn't have total alignment, whether it worked out or not?
Well, I don't want to be too specific because it's I'd tell you a good example I was right, because there's plenty I was wrong. But there's been examples with contract extensions, for example, where it's easy to with the contract extension, easy to only see the here and now, and there has to be some degree of projection. We challenge all our guys and girls that we work with. It's easy to report. We got to project. So with contract extensions, oftentimes, especially with young guys, you're trying to hit that really sweet spot where this is what you've done up to this point and what we think you'll do. And how can the deal, and not try to win the deal just for the team, how can the deal be good for you and the player? I'm always leery of getting the too team friendly a deal and having a guy not feel good about it, having a guy feel like he kind of got worked over. So I would say those are some of the situations where you got to say, hey, trust me on this one. It's going to be this is a good deal. This is a good kid. He's going to get better and better. You know, we're pretty convicted that the better that the guy feels, the better he'll play. We can't treat these guys like assets. They're our colleagues. Mm-hmm. So I think those are the situations where a couple of times, I'm fortunate that I worked with bosses that were cool enough to say, okay, this is your department. We hired you and trust you to make these decisions. So again, another situation where I was lucky because I was working with cool people.
How do you assess potential and how do you assess culture fit? But start with potential.
So the draft is a crapshoot. The draft, we'll know everything about a kid.
How do you say it's a crapshoot when you had the best draft pick in the history of mankind? And what, number 41 with Nicola?
Oh, we had two picks before him. So we're but I think the last 5 to 10 years, I think collectively, I think drafting's, we've probably gotten worse at it. We have too much information. There's information overload where, if this was Nicola's draft, you call the guys you know in Belgrade, you call the guys who coached him, you do a little background on his family. After 5 or 6 calls, you feel like you have a good sense of who the kid is. Obviously, you watch all his games, you watch him play. With the European guys in particular, the first question is, does he want to be here? There's been instances where high-level players don't want to be in the States. Mm-hmm. And I think now if this was – the drafts more recently, it's 6,000 intel reports. There's 4,000 videos about the guys online. So I don't think more information is better right now. And again, I think that's probably there's some connection there between that and lack of patience where, everyone wants to be right away. And these are kids. Nicola didn't come over his first year. He went back to Mega. His first summer league averaged 9-3. The expectation that's going to happen right away, I think, is a fallacy. So, but with the draft, you get all the information possible. You watch every possible video. You talk to, for us, we really challenge our guys to talk to only real relationships. You don't cold call someone. Don't put them in an uncomfortable position. No transaction relationships. And then, you second guess yourself all night and hopefully make a good pick.
But Tim, what's it mean, information overload? I've always heard, and what they preach in business schools is there's no such thing as too much information. But I love what you said, that there is such a thing as information overload. What's the downside?
Well, I think the downside is too many voices, and all the voices, you're not sure of the motive behind the voices and or the relationship behind the voices. So with our guys, I don't want to hear, if I want to talk about the 2-guard at Harvard and you and I are buddies, then I'll call Jeff. But I'm not going to cold call the third assistant and to expect that information to be the same level. I think it's unfair to the third assistant as well. So there's just so much information out there. 10, 15 years ago, the stuff that I knew, not everyone knew, whether it's the access to video, whether it's the access to salary cap data, background information. So there's so many smart people that are following this league. But there's so many smart people that are loudly sharing their opinions that it's if you're really keyed in and connected to all these different sources of information, I don't know how you make a decision because there's just so much going on.
So one of the key leadership skills from your point of view as general manager is having good judgment and knowing like how to zero in on the most important salient data so that you can make a good decision and not get overwhelmed by massive data.
Yeah. And I think, again, it's understand. It's still a pretty good chance you could get it wrong. You know, fearless is way too dramatic a word, but there's been situations. We had a situation early in my career where this kid had perfect background. This is a long, long time ago. Perfect background, had a very good first year. The NBA lifestyle ate him up. There was no predictor for that. None. You could not have had a more straight laced guy. I was in DC, and those are things you can't predict. So understanding you can do everything right and a guy get the NBA and the bright lights, big money and the temptation can really impact what he does and how he does it. So, the draft is really fun because it's, you know, we all think we know, but we really don't know. And the final thing with it, professional sports, is you're betting on 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, guys don't even know who they are as human beings yet. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a tremendous level of risk and, you know, unexpected outcomes, both good and bad, just because they're still in an age where they're just finding themselves.
Yeah, totally. And you talked about, you know, physical capability and talent. What about those human characteristics? Like, do you try to get more comfortable with human things like integrity and resilience and work ethic? And if so, like, how do you do that with kids that are coming out of college or from Europe or the G League versus somebody like an external superstar that you're recruiting into the organization?
Yeah, I think it's like we talk to our players all the time about controlling controllables. And I think that's controllable, the type of person you bring in. Who knows the type of player? You're guessing there to some degree, but we've had a lot of success. The staffs I've worked with and self-motivated guys that tend to not take themselves too seriously. You're in this, really, really big spotlight as a professional athlete, but the guys that, again, that have had the most success that I've worked with are guys that don't take themselves that seriously in that realm. They want to play basketball. They want to compete. And the competitive guys, it's really hard to teach. People want to be competitive, and they got to be self-motivated. You know, at this level, you have so much free time. We can't hold your hand to work. Can't hold your hand to compete. And then just like anything else, the pre-draft process will bring guys to here to get to know them. It's not about what they do on the court. We have hundreds of hours of video to see what they do on the court. It's just to, you know, have a burger with them and talk to them and see. You know, it's not like you get a real deep dive, but after 24 hours, 40 hours, you get a kind of sense of this guy's pretty cool. He'd be a fun colleague. He'd be a fun coworker. He would fit in culturally to what we're trying to do. So I think the ability to kind of identify certain key characteristics that augment and, kind of protect what your present core is from a basketball perspective is relatively easy. Once you get stars, we have elite players and Carl and Anthony and Rudy. It gets easier when you have the core. How do these guys complement the core? Certainly in Denver was all, how can he help and how can he protect Nikola? Then from a personal side, you get a sense, okay, how would these guys get along with Anthony? Would Carl like him? Well, when he gets in the locker room, would he be an energy bringer? And we're very, very aware of, we don't want to bring guys here that are going to be, you know, Debbie Downers. They're going to walk in a room and bring the mood down. It's a 82 games, it's a long season, man. So the more smiling, happy guys, more consistent energy guys you have, the better.
So did you ever think about bringing in James Harden?
Well, I'm not allowed to talk about other players, but I mean, he's a heck of a player. I mean, the last time, you know, he's been traded a couple of times. I think every team in the league has thought about bringing him in. He said, you know, first, he's going to be first ballot Hall of Famer. You know, unbelievably skilled guy. And again, a guy that, you don't get to where he gets without a tremendous, tremendous work ethic. So I'm not going to talk about any specific players or who we would or would not trade, but he's a great player.
Understood. But what about the you want somebody that's positive, that's going to get along with your core, with Kat, with Anthony, with Rudy. But how do you tell if somebody is potentially kind of going to fold under the bright lights of the NBA or how they're going to bounce back from a failure, you know, in a very long season?
We tried, yeah, but no. I mean, I think the second part of it, the resiliency, is the real question, because you're going to wilt. You're going to fail. I think resiliency is the one thing that is most consistent in the elite performers, the elite guys, because failure is guaranteed in our league. There's no linear path to success. The guys who've won multiple championships have also been bounced in the first round. They've also missed the playoffs. It's a very humbling game, like all professional sports is, but resiliency is the one thing that allows you to kind of get back up and get back out there.
And from your perspective as GM, you've seen resiliency as a common element of the super elite players every single time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think you can win at the highest level without being resilient. I think there's great players who lack that one thing. And I don't think it's accidental that they haven't, achieved the highest level of team success.
So tell me more about that. I mean, how does Cat or Anthony or Rudy deal with a really painful loss?
Well, they're all very different. All three great guys, all three, really obsessive competitors. And they all have different coping methods. But there's no one way to do it. I think, Rudy's a pretty spiritual guy. So he might do, I don't think Ant's doing a darkness retreat. Rudy did a darkness retreat last summer. So I don't think you'll see Anthony ever spending 48 hours in the dark. But each guy, how they cope, they have their own way. They've been doing this forever. But I think, the more high stakes situations you're in, the more, I wouldn't say failure is good. You don't want to lose. We want to be in those situations where we're losing big time playoff games. And hopefully we win more than we lose. But if you're always at that big table, there's going to be those moments of defeat. And how do you deal with it? And how do you bounce back? Anthony wants to be great. He wants to be one of the best players to ever do it. And we think he can. We challenge him when we don't talk about it, his present peer group. We challenge him with historical peer groups. What did Michael Jordan look like in year three? What did Dwayne Wade look like in year three? Because we think he has that level of talent and the mentality to really achieve those things.
Does he think that about himself?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he thinks about anything he does. He's got such an organic and really likable sense of confidence. People can be egotistical and they're not fun to be around. He's just smiling. He'll tell you, he'll tell you he's the best bowler. He'll tell you he's the best ping pong player. And he really means it. And he has a really refreshing personality, and he's a really, really, really nice person. He does a lot, he does a lot for a lot of people. Anthony's my teammate. It's not, we can't, he's going to at times, he'll be independent in his decision-making, and at times I'll be independent in my decision-making, but we don't want to create this a building that's separate. Ultimately, what we're trying to preach to our players is role acceptance is one of the biggest things. Team first, all these kind of cliche, cheesy things that we hear in sports all the time. But if they don't see that from...
Cheesy, but important, right?
Super. And if they don't see that from us, then we can't expect it from them. And again, I tell players all the time, look, you're my teammate. So you need to help us. If we need to make a trade, you would know better than I. Hey, can this guy do what we're trying to get him to do if we get him here? So I think Finchie does a wonderful job challenging these guys and being consistently honest. And then create real relationships. If the relationships are only created to be transactional, or only really called upon when there's something going really well or something's going really poorly, then these guys won't listen. I think the more that you develop the relationship, just develop the relationship, not just to develop a relationship with your star, the more hard conversation you can have. You can tell a guy you're garbage last night, or you're not working hard enough, or this friend of yours, I don't know about him. You got to be cognizant of the people you're around. So I think all those things in unison help you create a cool environment. And again, like any other, whether you're trying to win basketball games, you're selling insurance, mm-hmm. you want a happy office space. Mm-hmm. You want a workplace people want to come to. So we want our gym to be a fun place to be. And
well, let's talk about that. I mean, is it important for NBA teams to have a distinct culture like it is in corporate America?
Yes, but I think the culture can coddling the best player, or or bending over backwards for your players. It's everybody. It's from the guy who helps service the building to your best player. I think you can ensure that, like, it's a pretty fun place to work, and it's no different than corporate America. You know the companies, the CEOs that people are clamoring to get to. That's completely controllable whether you're winning or losing. It's much easier when you're winning. But it's controllable nonetheless. And I think, I don't want it to be drudgery. It's if I wanted a job in professional sports, my dream was not to be the GM of a team. My dream was to be a lead scout. That's what I wanted to do. Even once I was in the industry, I'd had no real aspirations to be in the lead chair. And I thought if I was ever given the opportunity to have any kind of real input on culture, it's got to be fun. Because there's so many unfun parts of sports. The success and failures are so public, right? So it's, when you're not playing well, it's not fun to be out and about, or go, you're you know, you're with your kids and someone makes a smart comment. That's not fun. It's not fun that you have very little control about where you live. You know, if you're, as you're trying to climb the corporate sports ladder, you got to bounce around a bunch. So if you can't have fun day to day, then it's just a brutal industry.
What about a coach? What are some of the most important leadership qualities and human qualities you look for in a great NBA coach? Not only yours, but any coach.
Transparency, ability to communicate, and to communicate without being overly emotional. Coaching is emotional, so you're going to coach emotionally. And I don't, there's any way to avoid that. The willingness to, kind of be vulnerable. It's a really, really hard job. I mean, these guys, you know, I share my suggestions, you know, talk to Finchie all the time, or I like to jot down notes and emails and occasionally send over these, the diary of madmen. I jokingly call them just these weird ideas, what I see, what I don't see. But I always tell these guys, you're the coach. I'm not, I will have no impact on what you do or how you do it. I'll never tell you to play anybody. Their jobs are, I mean, they speak to the media 3 times a day on game day. I mean, I couldn't imagine doing that 3 times a day. You're looking for intelligence, not just basketball intelligence. Michael Malone's a very smart guy. He's a fun guy to talk to above beyond basketball. Chris Finch is a really, really smart guy. You know, Franklin and Marshall comes from a family of educators. 80% of our conversations aren't about basketball. Developing those real relationships allows you to have the more difficult conversations when that time comes. Hey, why aren't we doing this? What can we do here? We always challenge each other to be curious. I'm not being critical. I'm just curious. I'm not attacking, but, you know, walk me through what we were thinking here. I know some sports teams throughout all the leagues, you have guys like myself, for the minute the game's over, say, why'd you do this? I couldn't imagine that being conducive to a healthy relationship. And then you got to let them do their job. You know, I got to get out of their way. Those guys are experts, best in the world. They're here for a reason. They don't need to have their hands held. They need to feel empowered to make decisions and feel confident that we'll have their back when they make those decisions.
So I totally agree. But what happens if you give them, you know, some notes and they don't follow it and it turns out to be wrong and you're right? How does that make you feel and how do you handle that?
There's been plenty of suggestions from the coach towards my way that I didn't listen to and I should have listened to. Mm-hmm. You see how hard these guys work. Mm-hmm. And if they work this hard, they're not trying to get it wrong. And they have to make so many micro decisions within a game. It's not easy. So there's no expectation of perfection of the coaching staff. The expectation is that they're going to try their hardest. They're going to be really intentional in their approach game to game. And then you just got to live with it. The last thing I want to do is get in their way.
Well, you mentioned vulnerability. That sounds like weakness, but it's not. It's actually something that's really important, leadership quality. Why did you mention it and why do you think it's so important?
If you'd have walked into a bar 15 years ago, you could have picked out the coaches just by who had the loudest voice, you know, who was holding court. I think this idea that the leaders always have to be the loudest, the most look at me guy or girl, I think, I think it's been wrong forever. I think we're finally just waking up to that. It's not about being the loudest. Especially in professional sports, there's so much ego already in that locker room. Being a bit egoless as a leader can really help make the players more vulnerable. So I don't think the days are gone where, you know, it's my way or the highway. I have the loudest voice. I'm going to scream you down and talk you off your point just because I'm louder and I want more people to look at me and hear me. So I do think professional sports, you see this kind of shifting landscape of what the coach looks like. And I think it's good. I think we're seeing a more diversity in personalities. There's not one way to be a really effective coach. You know, you can be a pretty bombastic guy. You can be a pretty quiet guy. But I think we're seeing some of the best leaders we've ever seen, you know, throughout all the sports right now.
And when you and Finchie are being vulnerable, it kind of sets the tone at the top. And it gives permission, you say, for the players to be somewhat vulnerable. In what way does vulnerability help someone like an Anthony Edwards?
Well, I think vulnerability meshes with self-deprecation too. So you can say, man, I'm my bad tonight, fellas, and really mean it. You know, say, there's not a player in the world that's performed at an elite level 82 games. It's never happened. You know, it's the best never done it. So there's going to be built-in nights where you're going to have to say my bad. And if you mean it, and the my bad, you know, doesn't mean you're not playing hard, doesn't mean you're not competing. My bad is, yeah, I had 6 turnovers tonight. I was 2 for 11 for three. But I don't think any elite athlete or really any elite mind can lead without being vulnerable or self-deprecating. I think if you only talk about your wins, I think it's really deflating to be around that person because, you know, I don't care who you are, you're going to screw up a lot. And if you don't share that loudly with your teammates mm-hmm. and your colleagues, I think it's a huge disservice.
And to your earlier point, you know, if you don't screw up even in practice, you're probably not stretching the bar far enough. And if Anthony Edwards is comparing himself to the best ever in the third year, like Michael Jordan or Dwayne Wade, then he wants to continuously, you know, push himself outside his comfort zone, which is absolutely going to lead to failures. And that's part of it.
Absolutely. I mean, the greatest leaders of all time. I mean, those guys have tremendous failures that are attached to these successes that have allowed them to kind of be seen as global leaders. So yeah, you can't be scared to fail. You can't be scared to take chances. Like turnovers is a good example. There's some good turnovers occasionally. Mm-hmm. If there was a purpose and it made sense and you just threw the ball a little high, a little low, we'll live with it. And then there's, you know, the lazy turnovers where you're not paying attention or you're doing something outside of your skill set. But we never want to create an environment that restricts creativity. We never want to create an environment that allows guys and to think that they can't fail, because there will be no raising bar of success if you're always scared to fail.
I love that so much. And you talked about earlier that you never really imagined yourself as a general manager of an NBA team, much less, you know, one of the most successful general managers of an NBA team. Tell me a little bit about your leadership journey.
It's, again, dumb luck. I got an internship when I was at Fordham, transferred to the Catholic University in DC. I thought I could, you know, be a very average Division III player. Got an internship, worked for free for several years. That turned into a real job. Worked for really neat guys in Wes Unseld Sr.
Oh wow,
Michael Jordan. I worked for Ernie Grunfeld. Three just like heavyweights. You know, guys that I've learned so much from. And it was really the kind of nascent stages of analytics. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of fun working with those guys. And, you know, I barely passed college math, but having to engross yourself in analytics. And that was really cool as that became more and more commonplace.
Did you engross yourself in analytics? I mean, were you kind of a Moneyball disciple?
I mean, I really enjoy it. And I really enjoyed getting to know the guys who were actually doing it. I was a consumer of it. I wasn't a creator of it. Yeah, I thought it was great. I think it's still great. I think it's a tool, not a gospel. I always tell coaches, never say you're a defensive coach. Never say you're an offensive coach. Say you're a coach. We challenge these players to be two-way guys. So it was really fun, you know, in the early stages, meeting these really cool minds and these guys and girls that were working in different industries. They're just obsessed with hoops or obsessed with baseball and having beers with them. It was a great, great time. Next big break was getting a full-time job. I could move out.
Finally, your parents were happy.
Yeah, like, benefits.
I got a job. I can't believe our kid got a
job. Oh, man, listen, I got benefits and I moved. I was commuting from Baltimore to D.C. It was not much of a social life. It was not a very successful guy on the dating scene, you know, driving an hour each way, making no money. Got a full-time job with the Wiz. And then, you know, again, then Ernie Grunfeld came in. He came in with success in Milwaukee and built the Knicks team in a finals level, championship level team, and learned more, kept learning more and learning. And then Dell Demps had a couple job offers, New Orleans, another team. And I was on a kind of a boys trip. I was scouting in Europe for 2 weeks. Then some buddies I grew up with met me in Europe and he called me and said, "Hey, what do you think, New Orleans?" And that was the big break. It became the assistant GM with the Hornets in 2010. And Dell taught me so much. And he came from that, you know, the storied halls of the Spurs, where, you know, the processes and the way they approach things were so cutting edge. And he taught me so much. Then I was sitting at a lunch with a bunch of draft guys at Emeralds in New Orleans, and
great food, by the way.
Fantastic. Yeah. I lived a block from there. Just New Orleans the other day. God, it's great. I thought I was going to come to Minnesota to be the GM. Flip Saunders was here. And Flip is the best. He was calling every night, just talking. And kind of out of nowhere, Josh Kroenke called. I knew Josh a little bit. We'd hung out once or twice, but Masai's, one of my best friends. I think Masai was my real agent. He got me the job in Denver. He said, "I want to fly you to Denver." Flew to Denver, expected a real formal interview process. You know, packed the suit, was ready to. We spent all Friday night cramming. You know, the salary cap situation, the coaches, the optionality, and sat down with Josh. And about an hour and a half, he asked a couple really smart kind of probing questions. And
like what?
Well, I thought one of the best questions he asked was, there was a guy that we had in New Orleans that wasn't working out. And he said, who made that decision? And I said, what do you mean who made that decision? Like who brought that guy there? I said, we brought that guy there. He said, what do you mean we brought him? So we collectively brought him there. And after that answer, he said, I want you to be the GM of the Nuggets. And so are you drunk? We're only two beers in, man.
And so right away, basically Josh was sending you the signal that you weren't a gunslinging solo guy making all the decisions yourself. It wasn't anybody. You were collectively making decisions as a team, and that resonated with Josh.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I didn't know that at the time. I wasn't smart enough to pick up on those cues at the time, but he told me soon thereafter, that was the question that was most impactful, because he does not want someone to just take the credit for the good and the bad, someone else's dirty work. So, I thought Josh has a tremendously high emotional IQ. I mean, look at the success they've had across all their brands.
Totally.
The Rams, the Avs, Arsenal's, Arsenal's kind of rebrand. They're such a fun team to watch. I thought it was a great question at the time. I really, really dislike when I hear people in any sport take credit or be critical of their colleagues outside their walls. Inside the walls, let's beat each other up. But when I hear someone on the road, man, I told our guy to trade this guy. They didn't listen. I liked him, but my boss didn't. I instantly X that person out from any potential, future employment.
It's so interesting to hear you say that. And Josh felt the same way. How nervous were you before a big meeting with Josh Kroenke, this huge owner, this incredible owner? Like I wouldn't have slept the night before. How did you feel?
Yeah. I mean, I was super nervous. I mean, it was uncharted territories. I was scared to death. But what was neat, and what turned into such a cool friendship, is he and I are pretty similar in our sense of humor, which is always a great icebreaker. And again, a guy that, a real global leader, he doesn't take himself that seriously. So, his stand's great. His mom's great. And again, now coming here, Glenn and Becky are salt of the earth, fantastic people. Mark, you won't find a nicer guy, Mark Laurie, and his, his success is a very unique one. He's a self-made guy. His first thing was baseball cards. He's working in finance, and then he was a dad and hated how he was buying diapers. So he did some e-commerce stuff there. That led to Jet, and then he completely revolutionized Walmart's e-commerce. And he's got a really cool thing now called Wonder. He's trying to disrupt the mobile food ordering. Just a guy, when you're around him, you feel his energy, you feel his intelligence. But he's not leading with his intelligence. He's leading with being a good guy.
Yeah, and Wonder is right down the block from my place in New York. So it looks so cool. I'm going to have to definitely use it.
Oh, Jeff, it's the tech behind it's amazing. And again, Mark's the ultimate risk taker. Mark completely switched up what was their, their original deck is no longer there. And his ability to change in the fly, I think, is going to lead to just huge, huge success. But you're around for 5 minutes. You're like, I like this guy. He's got good energy, and he's positive, and he's not talking down to you. So, again, everyone that I've worked for has had that, same really positive approach. And I've been super fortunate.
And A-Rod?
A-Rod's the best. I joke with him all the time. It hurts me that I like him as an Orioles fan. Like I don't want to like him, but he's unbelievably curious about the game. I mean, the guy's at more games than any owner, and not just our games. He's always going to games. He has such a unique feel for locker room dynamics and what it's like to be an elite athlete. His career has had these mega highs and these really tough lows. I've learned so much from him. This is a different sport than basketball, obviously, but he sees things that are hard to pick up externally.
Give me an example. Like what?
Well, he quickly will pick up on team dynamics. He'll say, you know, there's no connectivity there. There's no chemistry there. And sometimes it's not the obvious ones. It's just ones you got to be really in the locker room. You really have to be in tune with your players to know that's the case. He's really challenged us organizationally to be taken more seriously. Even last night, Alex and Ethan and Ryan, two really smart guys on the business side, these guys turned a space that was a dump into this kind of owner's lounge for Glenn and Becky Taylor and Mark and Alex. And I walked in last night, and if you close your eyes, you think you're in Miami or New York. And it's so our organization forever. I mean, I think we're we have had the least success of any team in the major four sports in the U.S. That's both sad and it's a huge opportunity for us, right? Okay. The ground is blank. Let's build up. So something that seemingly is small like that, to walk in that room last night, it made the arena feel different. You know, it made us feel a little more real. We have to believe in ourselves if everyone else can have to believe in it. So I think Alex has tremendous leadership, and he's been quickly become a really good friend. He's a super bright guy, and his work ethic is off the charts.
And he's a guy also, aside from his intellect and his sports acumen and his resilience, you know, having gone through so many ups and downs, he's a hell of an entrepreneur, isn't he?
He's great. I mean, I joke, I'm like a micro entrepreneur, and he does it at a macro level. You know, he has real access to capital. He's doing these awesome projects throughout. And it's really inspiring to see how many hats he wears, and he learns. You know, he's not just an investor and steps away. He's an active participant in all his investments. He bought a house in Minnesota. He's hosted these great parties. He's really trying to get to know the people in Minnesota. And some of the stuff, the success he's done off the field is really impactful for our guys, because we really challenge our guys to have some game plan for post-playing success. And there's no better person to look at than Alex. So we're lucky to have him as a leader and an owner. And it's, he's going to sit down with our guys, him and Mark, at some point this year, and walk them through their whole story. Right now, they just know Alex was a great baseball player. We've made a lot of money off the field. He doesn't know how he got there. They know Mark Lori made a lot of money in e-commerce. They don't know how he got there. So it's fun to be able to tell those stories to our guys.
And I think it's going to resonate. It's going to be so authentic. And what I can already imagine is, again, like all of the serious ups and serious downs, you know, of A-Rod and Mark probably too. And I think that's going to resonate with a young kid like Anthony and probably everybody else on the team. So I would encourage them to, you know, talk about some of the failures and what they learned from that as well. And I could imagine that's going to be a powerful meeting.
Yeah. Anthony went to a couple of games with them, with Alex last year. And he was like, why does Alex want me to go to a game with him? He said, well, because he really likes you. You're really important in our organization, but just go down there and be open-minded. And he had a blast. And then he's, when are we going again? So we really try to expose our guys to as many smart, creative minds as possible. Not just ownership, but if guys have interest in the art world, we have buddies in the art world. If guys have interest in the real estate world, if guys have what's a healthy, sustainable nonprofit look like. So we don't want these guys to be robots, and we're trying to engage their minds on several different fronts.
Listen, Tim, thank you so much. We really appreciate your vulnerability and your wisdom and being so open and honest with us. So thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Imperfect Leaders. If you have a question for our guest, feel free to reach out at www.imperfectleaders.com. Until then, we'll see you next week.